Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We continue our conversation with Dr. David Menten on creation and evolution, discussing some of the basic questions surrounding the conflict between these two explanations for the origin not only of life, but of everything there is. And as we continue that conversation, we invite your questions and your comments, either via the telephone or our email address here in the studio. It's Sunday night, October the 8th. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. David Menten, joining us here in Studio A, is Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and he's a speaker for Answers in Genesis. Let's go straight to the phone. Scott is listening in Arlington Heights, Illinois, and he listens on WYLL. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thank you. You know, years ago, I was taught by Carl Sagan and others that there were actually cells that were simple, and that because they were simple, they could come in by chance. And years later, I was just wondering where the scientific community stands with it, with the advent of probability science and, you know, entropy and so forth. Has the scientific community look at that, you know, as a bad argument these days, as a simple cell coming in by chance?
Scott, thank you very much. A good question. That's, I think, what I remember being taught, too, when it came to the origins of the, what we always said, single-celled life, that these things kind of fell together in the primordial soup.
I would say in all of the things that evolutionists purport to explain, that which they've done most poorly is the origin of life. They really have never come up with anything remotely like an adequate explanation. And, of course, if you can't get life started, you can pretty well write off everything subsequent to that since you didn't get to first base. There is no simple cell, I can assure you of that. Since Carl Sagan made that comment 20 years ago or more, I can tell you our knowledge of the cell has increased exponentially. And if we thought a cell was complicated 20 years ago, today it's a whole different ballgame. I mean, it's complex beyond our wildest imagination.
Is the cell, say a human cell in our bodies, is it an example of that irreducible complexity, that it is so complex that if a single part ceases or does not function the way it does in the cell, the entire cell does not, cannot sustain itself as a living organism? Or is that a good example to use?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would accept irreducible complexity in the context of a cell. I'm sure one can always argue that you could be minus, you know, one copy of this protein or one, you know. In fact, I guess I'm less impressed with the irreducible complexity argument than some. Michael Behe sort of gives us the impression until he came along in, what, the 80s and came up with the idea of irreducible complexity that we really didn't have a compelling argument for complexity in nature. And the Bible's been telling us all along that we can see from what God has made, from his visible things he's made, his power and majesty. We didn't need irreducible complexity. The cell, even an organism that's made from a single cell, far from being a simple cell, when an organism has to make do with its entire body being one cell, like a protozoan, that one cell is, if anything, more complicated than the specialized cells we have in our body. I mean, our body, we have virtually hundreds of different kinds of cells that make up the two or three dozen different organs that are in our body, different kinds of organs and organ systems. And each of these cells contains an identical set of DNA, as far as we know, but it's expressed a different part of it. It's like having a library full of books, but you're only going to read some of the books. And so only certain books are available to be expressed. So one cell will make hemoglobin if it's a blood cell, red blood cell. Another one will make antibodies if it's a plasma cell, and on it goes. But in addition to doing these specialized jobs, these cells have to do something else called being alive. I know that's a popular old tune, but being alive is a pretty complicated business. Several years ago, a very distinguished cell biologist, David Green, and a Nobel laureate, said that as nearly as he could tell, approximately one-third of the genetic inventory of the cell That is, of all the genetic information, about one-third of it was devoted to just being alive. In other words, you couldn't even play the evolution game if you're not alive, right? I mean, if the cell dies, it's pretty much it. And he was talking about, the bioenergetics of the cell, an area in which he was an expert, the mitochondria producing storage forms of energy and what have you. And he made that point at the time, and he was hardly a creationist, that if a third of the genetic inventory is necessary to just be alive, what's left for evolution? I mean, you need that much just to start playing.
Right. If you're fiddling with the being alive part of your genetic code, you're fiddling with your very existence then.
That's right. In other words, let's say you're going to go on to form a cardiac muscle cell, a heart muscle cell, okay? But before you can play around or, in quotes, experiment with becoming a cardiac muscle cell, you first of all need to be a living cell, just for starters. You have to be able to divide. You have to be able to metabolize, utilize food. And this takes up a large part of the whole part of the cell.
Carl writes this from Mountain View, California. My question pertains to creation and death. In Genesis 1, God saw the creatures that he had made as good, and he saw everything that he had made as very good. Please describe the Hebrew words for good and very good. Is the same word for good in Genesis 25 describe Adam's dying in a good old age? I'll deal with the first part of your question here, if you don't mind, Carl, and Dr. Menton, if you don't mind.
Oh, go right ahead.
the words themselves are really just simple words. There's nothing magic about the words. Very good is simple. If you're interested in Hebrew, it's tov ma'od, good, followed by the modifier very good. And the connotation of this word can be as simple as good as opposed to bad. But here, in the Genesis account, I think the context would lead us to conclude that it's not simply God isn't making a moral judgment about creation. That's simply a given. He is not saying this is good as opposed to bad. He's saying this is finished and complete and according to his design, as opposed to incomplete and not yet according to his design. So God creates the world gradually over 6 consecutive days. And at each stage, he pronounces it to be good. And he's saying, this is good. I'm finished with this. I'm done with my job here. And at the very end, he says, it is indeed good. Everything is indeed good. Now, of course, that's all written in the context of that account is setting us up for the fall when things aren't good any longer and when that original goodness is marred by our sin. Now, as to the question, your second question about Genesis 25, it's exactly the same word, but again, a different context. So there it probably just means good old age, like some of us hope to enjoy later in life. Now, Dr. Menton, let's go to a question about creation and death. Is there a problem with that whole subject for those who want to find a halfway house between the Genesis account of creation, as it reads, and the theory of evolution, so-called theistic evolution?
Oh, my goodness. Not only a problem, but to me it's the whole defining issue in the creation-evolution controversy. You see, you can't have evolution without death. Carl Sagan some years ago on a television program actually used the expression that the engine of evolution is death, that you can't have evolution without death. That is, you have to have all of the ill-suited organisms die off and be replaced by something else that's better. So death is necessary. And even the old Earth, if we think the Earth is, millions and millions of years old because of the fossils are all dead. And so if God created progressively over millions of years, everything he created died right after he created it. And in the Bible, we're told that certainly for man, and I believe for everything having the breath of life, that death was not part of our original creation. God did not create us with the intention that we would die. After all, I remember in confirmation class years ago, I learned that Jesus came into the world to save us from sin, death, and the power of the devil. If God's the author of death, if he produced death from the beginning, Christ came to save us from a mess that God created? No, it's a mess we created.
Let's talk about more of that on the other side of this break. Very well put. We've had that question many times here on Issues, Etc. And Dr. David Menton gave the best nutshell response I've heard in a long time. We're talking with him about creation and evolution. We want to talk with you as well. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. What I want to take up on the other side of the break is this whole attempt, and I think it is a well-intentioned attempt, but the attempt generally on the part of Christians to find that halfway house between evolution and the Genesis account. Is the issue of death the only problem that theistic evolution has? Stay tuned. It's never too early to begin teaching your kids or your grandkids the substance of the Christian faith. Are you looking for a children's book with real Christian scriptural substance? Hi, I'm Todd Wilkin. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for October is called The Apostles' Creed. It teaches the basics of the doctrine of the Trinity right at the level of your children or grandchildren. You can find The Apostles' Creed at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores in the St. Louis area. One is on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, the other at 3558 South Jefferson in the city. The Issues Etc. book of the month for October, The Apostles' Creed, is a great way to begin teaching your children the truths of the Christian faith. Visit either of those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Look for the Issues Etc. book of the month for October, The Apostles' Creed.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Noted author and Christian apologist Craig Hawkins on why you should support Issues Etc.
It's my pleasure to recommend to you Issues Etc. It's one of the few programs discussing crucial concerns for Christians. It's done in a dynamic format, again discussing crucial issues, and in an insightful manner. The program is very much needed. In my opinion, it's one of the most important broadcasts on the air, and it's one of my favorites. So if you want to grow in your faith, know what you believe and why, then this program is for you. I want to encourage you to listen, and I want to encourage you to support the broadcast, both prayerfully and financially.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift this week. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can make a credit card donation by calling our resource line. That number is 1-800-737-0172.
We're talking about creation and evolution tonight on Issues Etc. Dr. David Menton is our guest, Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine here in St. Louis. He's a speaker for Answers in Genesis. You can check out the website for Answers in Genesis by visiting our website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links, you're going to find a direct link to Dr. David Menton, our guest, and Answers in Genesis. Or if you'd like information on how to receive their Answers magazine, it's a great resource. Call the Issues Etc. resource line, 1-800-737-0172, and we'll be happy to send you the phone number and the mailing address for Answers in Genesis. That resource line number, 1-800-737-0172. We were talking before the break about the biggest problem that evolution poses in terms of Christian theology, that you say it undermines the very cross of Jesus Christ and his salvific work for us there at the cross. That's a problem that theistic evolution shares with full-blown evolution. Are there other problems with theistic evolution, the so-called halfway house between the creation account and the evolutionary theory, beyond that big, insurmountable one?
Well, you know, we can look at the words of Christ himself. What did Jesus Christ believe about, say, the origin of man? I mean, a lot of people are perhaps surprised to find that the Bible does comment on Jesus Christ's understanding of the origin of man, but at least two places in Scripture, one of which is Matthew chapter 19, verse 4. Remember, at this point, Christ had been challenged about if a woman had been married four, five, six, I don't know, seven times, each husband dying and being replaced, then whose husband would she be in heaven? And Jesus comes back with, have you not read that he that made them in the beginning, or I think this related to divorcement, have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female? That's Matthew 19:4. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Clearly, Jesus Christ says here that in the beginning, at the very start of things, God created male and female, a man and a woman, and established what we would call marriage. And this is the only place where we have the establishment of marriage, at least for the first time, is here in Genesis. So many things have their beginning there. That's why we call this organization Answers in Genesis that I work for, because there are so many answers there. And so Jesus Christ clearly understood man as having been created from the beginning as male and female, and that they would have offspring.
And he cast no doubt on the Genesis account in the plain and simple reading as a six-day creation.
And he cast no doubt on the flood that covered the whole earth. And there again, that's another point contested by Christians. You know, when you get right down to it, what we're dealing with here, Todd, is man considering himself to be autonomous and that he will stand in judgment of God's word. God's in the docket and man's on the bench. And man will decide what is reasonable, what is plausible to believe in the Bible. God gets too heavy with the miracles. We say, lighten up. We know that didn't happen. And this ultimately undermines the gospel itself. Jesus said, if I've told you earthly things and you haven't believed, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things? And the short answer is you won't.
Let's talk with Eric in St. Louis. He listens on KSIV. Hi, Eric.
Good evening. Fantastic topic, by the way.
Thank you.
I find that when I'm speaking to my highly intelligent friends and the issue of evolution comes up, what I'm sensing from these individuals is they're wanting to wrap their brains around the issue of God. In other words, they want to bring God closer on their level, if you would. I think that's what this whole issue is about, evolution, creation. Man, by nature, man wants to conquer something. Man wants to wrap his brain around it. If he's able to wrap his brain around it, now it's no more mysterious. It's no longer mysterious. That's the problem with people in general, for that matter. We always want to wrap our brains around God.
Eric, thank you for the call. It goes nicely with what you were just saying, Dr. Menton.
Yeah, I would say that we're not trying to bring God closer with an evolutionary explanation. We're really trying to make him more distant. For example, if we can put creation off, you know, millions and millions of years, God sort of created everything knowing that if he just walked off someplace and ignored it, that matter and energy left to itself sooner or later would get around to forming people. As somebody once said, hydrogen is a colorless and odorless gas, which if given enough time turns into people. And I happen not to believe that. But that makes God more distant. It's not making him closer, but I certainly accept the comment that man wants to try to understand everything. And I can tell you, based on my experience of 34 years teaching at a distinguished medical school, that after 34 years I was beginning to understand how little I knew.
Paul writes this, and he listens on WRRD in Milwaukee. Does government funding of scientific projects, he gives the example of the NSF, and academic peer and administrative pressure significantly serve to keep evolution as credible before the secular and Christian American public? Would it get many votes as good scholarship at the faculty meeting if the lights were out? So how much, you come out of academia, how much does that kind of pressure bear upon keeping evolution put forth as a credible theory in the classroom, whether it be higher education, secondary education, whatever it is?
Well, certainly there's no federal funding available to criticize evolution. Nobody's going to give you funding to show that man did not evolve from ape-like ancestors. And so the federal funding agencies exclusively support the evolutionary paradigm. And no doubt this is part of the reason why it comes up in the classroom, because people like to talk about what they're doing in terms of their research and what have you. But, it's a government driven, just like you've had the stem cell research thing. The government, the NIH, is supporting embryonic stem cell. But they support, to a much lesser extent, adult stem cells. So they're, by what they fund, they're pushing the thinking in a particular direction.
So that is the biggest factor, in your opinion, about why in academic research and in the classroom, evolution continues to have currency?
I don't think that's the biggest reason. No, I was just responding to the fact that, yes, the funding plays a role. I really think the real reason is worldview. I think the question I'm asked most often when I go around speaking is, how can all these brilliant men and women of science believe that an expanding cloud of hydrogen gas turned into people? And the answer is simple. It's their whole worldview. It's the glue that makes sense. They stand as autonomous to decide what is believable from a god, or indeed if they wish to even believe in a god. They want to decide for themselves what's right and wrong. I mean, this is an old principle. Remember, that's what Satan told Eve. First of all, he said, did God really say? And that's, of course, what we're still doing. That's what evolution's all about. Did God really say what he said? And then second, you shall be as gods. That's why he doesn't want you to eat of this tree. You'll be as gods, knowing good from evil. And that's where we are today. We are as gods, deciding for ourselves what's right and what's wrong. And no one's going to tell us differently.
Dr. David Menton is our guest. We continue our conversation on creation and evolution tonight on Issues Etc. He's Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He's also a speaker for Answers in Genesis. Join us with your questions and your comments on creation and evolution. The best emailers in the call and callers tonight on that subject will get a pamphlet called What About Creation and Evolution? Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, or call us 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back from this break, we're going to be turning to the subject of, I guess people would say, we have been talking about the dating before. People would say, if we look at the fossil record, how else do we explain? Layer upon layer upon layer. Deep, deep layers of sediments that seem to have been laid down over millions and millions of years. And all of those bones, all of those fossils, there in those strata. We'll be right back.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith, culture editor for World Magazine, on the value of LCMS World Relief.
Well, you know, whenever I see news of a disaster or a terrorist attack or a natural calamity, I hear that just immediately they're on the front lines of this. And as a Lutheran, I feel so proud about that, not in a boastful way, but I feel happy that Lutherans care about the suffering of others, as our theology teaches us to, that we're to live out our faith in love and service to our neighbors.
LCMS World Relief provides Christ-centered, cross-focused care and concern. For more information, contact them at 314-996-1683 or look for the LCMS World Relief logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again, talking with Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, about the world's AIDS crisis. Matt, talk about how the AIDS crisis especially affects children.
Nearly 20% of AIDS deaths are children. Children who, through absolutely no ethical or moral fault of their own, have this curse upon them. And these are children where it's very easy to look upon them in pictures and say, well, they are those children. But then you meet them, each one of them, and you hear each one's name. And you talk to them about where they go to church and what they dream about and what they would like to have in their little lives. Something as simple as a chair, let alone a toy or a bed or somebody who loves them. And you can't but respond.
How is LCMS World Relief and the many who support it, how are they responding to this crisis?
Traditionally, we've done most of the response by way of education. That is, we've provided resources to our partners, many in Africa, but also AIDS in Thailand becomes a real challenge, is becoming an extreme challenge, and also in Russia, providing dollars so that pastors, church workers, health workers can be trained on AIDS. So education is very important, and we believe education is really key within a strong Lutheran context of law and gospel, and one that has a proper understanding of sexuality as God's gift, and the blessings that God gives us there, and the blessings of faithfulness and monogamy. So that has been important. We have, in the last several years, been very active with several orphanages in Kenya, and that has been just a wonderful joy. We just finished building a brand new orphanage that houses about 60 children. It's amazing. For about $30,000, we were able to build a complete orphanage. We just added to the Matango Orphanage in western Kenya an entire medical clinic for really very little money comparatively. And we're increasingly going in this direction, providing resources for congregations in Africa so they can deal with their own HIV/AIDS orphans.
LCMS World Relief offers Christ-centered, cross-focused help to victims of the world's AIDS crisis. For more information about LCMS World Relief, find them at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438, LCMS World Relief, concerned for both body and soul.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. David Menton is our guest. We're continuing our conversation on creation and evolution. Let's go back to the phones, where Tim waits in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, listening on WEMI. Hi, Tim. Thanks for waiting.
Is the philosophy of evolution responsible for society's ills, like abortion, homosexuality, pornography, violence, promiscuity, and drugs?
Thank you, Tim. Good question. Well, let's talk about the ethical implications of what he calls the philosophy of evolution. Would you make connections?
I'm not sure I would say, responsible for, we could say responsible for racism. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould, who, of course, his evolutionary credentials were above reproach, the late Stephen Jay Gould, and he said that, Darwinism didn't exactly invent racism, but it put it on a scientific footing. I think what we can say is that evolution is entirely consistent with a lot of the things that he mentioned. And, direct cause, it is a supporting view that favors. For example, take abortion. If man is just simply another animal, if we can share the cover with time, our soulmate, and if we can be told that we're essentially the same thing genetically, that we've evolved by a mindless and purposeless process, then who are we to think we're special compared to an ape or a mouse, for that matter? And naturally, that's going to impact on the way you look at a child developing in the womb. In fact, I would challenge any pro-life person, although I'm very pro-life myself, I would challenge them to a debate. If they're willing to take the evolutionary view, they're going to lose that debate, because you can't make a consistent argument, pro-life argument, apart from, in my view, apart from God's creative work and His Word.
So in a nutshell, you would not say that the direct cause of these things is the theory of evolution, but there's nothing in the theory of evolution that provides us with sound ethical arguments against things like abortion or racism. In fact, they would tend to support the views.
Some of the implications of evolution would support, for example, even the great industrialists took a very nature-red and tooth-and-claw type of approach, Andrew Carnegie and what have you. It was perfectly okay to push down the downtrodden and starve them out and work them at slave labor, because this was justified by evolution. Hitler was very big into evolution. So was Mussolini. They justified their wars because they were the Übermensch.
This is an email that comes from, who's the email from, Jeff? The email comes from Martin in Chicago. He says, and I've actually seen these things myself. Tell us about the dinosaur and human prints in the same strata of rock in Texas. Prints anywhere else, he asks. Are you surprised to find human prints next to dinosaur prints? And what does it say in the Bible about humans coexisting with dinosaurs, if anything at all?
First of all, I would be surprised, and I would not be surprised, I guess, in terms of finding dinosaur and human footprints together. I'm not sure humans and dinosaurs really hobnobbed, that they hung out mm-hmm. together, no more than humans and alligators, you know, do a lot of hobnobbing, or crocodiles. The point is, in the case of the Glen Rose footprints, I'm not entirely convinced that they are the genuine article as described. I have seen these footprints. I respect the gentleman who has popularized them, a good friend of mine, Carl Bow, a dear man. I appreciate his efforts on behalf of the Lord and what have you, but I respectfully disagree with him that these are human footprints. Some of them clearly were carved. I have a print that Carl Bow gave me some years ago. It's a metal cast, and I can tell you as an anatomist, it's a car footprint. Mm-hmm. A very naive person who didn't know the details of the human footprint carved that, and an anatomist can pick up on that pretty quickly. Am I going to say all of the prints that have been found are carved? No, not necessarily. I believe some of the prints represent from the dinosaur where the sort of tail dragged or the elbow goes down. I just respectfully disagree that these prints are there. Now, do I believe dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time? Absolutely. They didn't necessarily live in the same habitat. For example, I'm not aware of any place where human fossils have been found in association with kangaroos. Does that prove that man and kangaroos did not live at the same time on this earth? No. It just tells us something about where we find these fossils. As for the Bible speaking of dinosaurs, I think it's certainly plausible to consider that Behemoth, for example, was a dinosaur. Certainly its description does not fit what the NIV says Behemoth is. My NIV study Bible, including my Concordia version of it, indicates that that Behemoth was either perhaps a elephant or a hippopotamus, but the description of Behemoth just doesn't fit at all. Behemoth has an immense tail, for example, like a cedar, be like the cedars of Lebanon. Ribs is great bars of iron, and was chief among the created things of God. And it was something clearly that Job was familiar with. That, you know, consider Behemoth. Mm-hmm. And by the way, consider Behemoth that I made along with you. It sounds like created at the same time as man, which indeed it would have been on the same day of creation, because all dinosaurs are terrestrial creatures. Those that live in the water really aren't dinosaurs, the plesiosaurs and what have you. Those that fly in the air or flying reptiles are really not dinosaurs like pterodactyls. So I believe it's entirely plausible. I believe the dragons spoken of in the Bible may well be dinosaurs, and there's a lot of evidence of human beings painting dinosaurs in walls of caves, petroglyphs. In some cases, you can tell what species of dinosaur, that it is, in fact, a sauropod.
Okay, that leads us to the question I had posed before the break. We had talked about dating before, and without revisiting the whole carbon dating issue unnecessarily, someone looks at the strata of rock here in this area of the country. We've got a lot of this to look at because they carve our highways through some pretty big hills in southern Missouri in particular. You can drive down the highway and see layer after layer of rock, very easily discernible. And these layers are deep. And someone's going to say, how other than over millions of years were not only these layers of sediment laid down, which are discernible to the naked eye, but also, if you dig in them, you're going to find fossilized bones, if not over the millions of years as proposed by the evolutionary theory for the origins of life.
Well, I don't know about you, Todd, but when I drive through a road cut and see all those layers, knowing they were all deposited by water and knowing there must have been a lot of water around at one time to deposit, I find myself holding my breath. You know, my friend Ken Ham always speaks of fossils in the fossil record as being, you know, billions of dead things buried in rock layers deposited by water all over the earth, and that's precisely what you would expect from a global flood, such as a flood of Noah. The interesting thing is when you look at those layers, I mean, first of all, they are sediments. They are water-deposited sediments, no question about that. And you notice how straight they are. I mean, they can be folded, but the folding would have to occur after they were deposited. And to be folded, as you sometimes see, they would still have to be malleable. They didn't crack. In other words, the material was soft through all of the layers to get some of these folds.
Mm-hmm. They're curved layers in some cases.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the fossils that are contained in these layers, I mean, how long would you expect a fish, let's say if we're looking at a fish fossil, I mean, how many million years would you expect it to take before the fish completely rotted and couldn't be fossilized? I mean, that's a silly question because, of course, it would just take hours or days. And so the fossilization process didn't take millions of years. I think even evolutionists agree that the fossils themselves had to be formed very quickly.
In other words, these bones, when they were bones, buried quickly. So
that's
they
right.
could be fossilized.
So in other words, if we look at a layer, let's say we look at a 2-foot thick layer, and in this layer we see this large fish, and he's got a dorsal fin and a ventral fin. We can't believe the dorsal fin was deposited or was fossilized a million years later than the ventral fin just because it's higher. No, the whole fish had to be deposited so quickly. In fact, we have fossils of fish eating fish, where the meal isn't even completely down yet, and the animal is fossilized. So the fossilization process would have to require extraordinary circumstances, which I believe would have obtained really only at the time of the flood. Today, fish really aren't making fossils. Look down at the bottom of the lake. There's not a lot of fossils being made down there. I mean, they decompose. So fossilization is a quick process. I believe the sediment layers were laid down very, very quickly. And I don't know if time permits, but to me, one of the most stunning things about those layers is just keep your eye out for this. Absolutely tabletop smooth or maybe gently folded. But you never see any ditches in it. You never see any ravines. You never see any caves. I mean, mile after mile after mile, it's absolutely smooth as a billiard table. And yet, if we look at the surface of our Earth today, there are ditches and Grand Canyons and huge caves everywhere. But below this highly corrugated surface, it's our horizon today, we have this tabletop smooth layer after layer. How can we believe these were exposed layers for millions of years and had no erosion?
That's a very good point. Dr. David Menton is our guest. We're talking about creation and evolution. When we come back from this break, 10 more minutes on this subject. We'll take your phone calls and your email as time permits. 1-800-730-2727. Or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine here in St. Louis, and he's speaker for Answers in Genesis. I guess there's one other question that we should pose about the whole Noah's Ark, because, and this is an objection often raised by critics of the Noah account in general, but also the Noah account as it pertains to an alternate explanation to that of evolution. They'll say, look, even the biblical account doesn't have Noah on some huge ocean liner with millions of species of animal, each with their own little cabin, each with their own little suite. No, it's a relatively small ship, and it carries a relatively few number of species. So how do we explain the vast number today? We'll be right back. Issues Etc. guest, Dr. Arthur Just, on the Good Shepherd Institute, November 5th through 7th, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We are dedicated to hearing and discerning the clear voice of Jesus, the Good Shepherd, through our attention to the preaching, the historic liturgies, the catechesis, and the hymns of the church that communicate Christ. We hold a yearly conference during All Saints weekend, in which we explore these things. We're particularly interested in serving congregations and parishes, parish pastors, musicians, and other church workers, and also helping the laity to come to love and appreciate the treasures of our Lutheran faith and our Lutheran liturgy and our Lutheran life.
Join Issues Etc. as we broadcast live from the Good Shepherd Institute, November 5th through 7th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, look for the Good Shepherd Institute logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You are listening to Issues Etc.
The new I Have Issues t-shirts are available, and there's only one way to get one, by joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annual donor program. You'll find the statement, I Have Issues, on the front of the shirt, and on the back, the Issues Etc. logo, our website address, and the slogan, Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. Now, anyone who joins the Issues Etc. Reformation Club between now and the end of 2006 will receive the I Have Issues t-shirt, plus other membership benefits like monthly tapes, books, and transcripts. Now, for more information on the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us reach our goal of 300 Reformation Club members by the end of the year. We'll also send an Issues Etc. t-shirt, travel mug, and pen to current Reformation Club members who upgrade their membership. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Well, I tell you what, folks, a conversation when the mic is off is as interesting as a conversation when it's on. We should just leave the microphone on the whole time. It's very interesting speaking tonight about creation and evolution with Dr. David Menton, our guest. He's Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis and a speaker for Answers in Genesis. Now, we have several resources just for you posted at our Issues Etc. website on this subject. Go to the What's New section of our website. Issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. When you go there, under the What's New section, you're going to find this resource written by our guest, Dr. David Menton, called Is God an Evolutionist? I recommend you go there and you read it. Now let's go back to the phones. Keith calls from Lawrence, Kansas, listening on KCVV. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yeah, thank you very much. Really appreciate what you guys are talking about. I had a statement, you know, that I wanted you to respond to. You know, the chimps are still here, you know, and then you mentioned that they're not allowing criticism of evolution in schools, and I thought, man, that's just really outrageous. And what is being done about that, or what's with that?
All right, Keith, thank you very much. Well, let's respond to his statement, first of all. Is it legitimate to say, look, if evolution were true, then why do we still have New World apes? Shouldn't they have evolved into something else?
Yeah, that's a question I hear quite often from particularly other Christians, and I think it's not a really good question. It's one we ought to think through a little bit. For example, the evolutionist is not claiming that chimps and modern-day apes evolved into people, because if they did, then you would expect perhaps to exhaust the supply of chimps as they turn mm-hmm. into humans. But what the evolutionist is claiming, and of course I don't accept this, but we want to take them accurately at their claim, is going back about 5 million years ago, according to them, and I don't accept these timescales, chimps and apes alive today had a common ancestor with man alive today. So that the apes have been evolving for the same 5 million years that
along the
humans
ape line.
Right, mm-hmm. along the ape line. The thing that's really interesting, Todd, is this. If you look at a typical chart, you see all these creatures, you know, amanuensis and Australopithecus robustus and africanus and afarensis and da-da-da-da-da, and we have all of these so-called pre-humans, you know, these ape-like humans, these hominids. But if you go down to the bottom at the common ancestor again between chimps and man, and you follow the chimp line, there's nothing.
There are no intermediate steps between
That's right,
common ancestor and chimp.
That's right. And what this basically tells us is that we've essentially told the apes, if you're interested in your ancestry, go dig it up for yourself, because we're looking at humans. In fact, if you go back to the Miocene, we're supposed to have all apes. See, this is like over 5 million years ago. So it's like from 5 million years ago to 22 million years ago. And again, I don't accept these dates. This was sort of the age of apes, as it were. The interesting thing is we don't have any apes from that age because they've all been usurped or taken over to be human ancestors. So we basically flushed out all of the apes because who wants to go out and find an ancestral ape? There's no money in it. There's no prestige in it. If with a little extra effort you can declare it to be an ancestor of man, your career is set. And so as a result, you'll look far and wide to find any ape ancestors. But the question why we still have apes, of course, I think is not good because no one is arguing that apes evolved into humans
directly. Mischaracterized the evolutionist's claim. Let's talk with Dave in O'Fallon, Missouri. He listens on KSIV. Hi, Dave.
Hi. If I can just start off with a side comment and then get into my question real quick. Side comment, I didn't hear your full response concerning dinosaurs, but I think it has been noted that it's been, humans have been found right along with dinosaur bones so that they were coexisted. And then the question I have is, I think I read somewhere that you can actually make diamonds, that they've actually commercially made them. Is that true, and how does that bear on creation type things?
All right, Dave, thank you very much. Let's deal with the second one first, because we did address that question before. Let's talk about the industrial production of diamonds that we are told are the oldest pure carbon substances on Earth.
Yeah, not only diamonds, but other things, opals, for example, that are also supposed to be very, very old. These sorts of gems have been produced in the laboratory under conditions of certain pressure and conditions that have produced them. And we're talking about a matter of hours or days to produce opals and diamonds and what have you. And the thing that's really amusing is that whenever they do this, you always read in the descriptions in the popular accounts that isn't it amazing that we can do in 4 hours what it took evolution, 3 million years or 3 billion years to do. And they don't consider the possibility that under different conditions it may not have taken that 3 million years, of course, or that 3 billion years. But, yeah, it's true. A lot of things. Even oil. Oil has been produced in the laboratory in very short order. And so there's nothing that's known to take more time than we have, even from a creation point of view.
I mentioned a question before, but I do want to get to it because it would tie nicely and tie up our conversation on the whole sediment question. Someone's going to say, look, Noah, even by the biblical account of Noah and the flood, there is a very limited number of species that Noah is able to take on that ark with him to survive a worldwide flood. It simply cannot account for the plethora of species that we find on Earth today. What's your simple response to that objection?
I guess my first response would be it was a big boat. The Lord didn't need to use a big boat. He could have used a teacup, but it was a big boat. It would have held approximately 500 railroad cattle cars in terms of capacity for animals. And you don't have to put all the animals on it. Of all of the millions of species of animals that we have recognized today, a relatively small percentage of them would have been on the ark. For example, you can eliminate all the fish. There were no aquaria on the ark. You can eliminate the insects. You can eliminate all the marine invertebrates already. We're considering the bulk of living species on Earth today. The plants don't have to be on there. Most organisms, if you look at all the different phyla, most of the phyla are aquatic or survive for extended periods of time in an aquatic environment, such as insects. Maybe don't normally live there, but they can survive a flood.
Mm-hmm.
At least they would have survived enough numbers to continue to perpetuate after the flood. The animals that did have to go aboard the ark would be basically your absolutely air-breathing, terrestrial, land-type animal. And the ark was big enough to do the job. As I understand it, there's been a rather fascinating book written by a guy named Woodmorap. You can get this from the Answers in Genesis website. It's called A Feasibility Study of Noah's Ark by John Woodmorap.
And God did it without doing a feasibility study. That's the amazing
That's
thing.
That's right.
To find out how to contact our guest in this hour, Dr. David Menton and Answers in Genesis, or to join our monthly and annual donor program called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, call our resource line 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The address, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University School of Medicine here in St. Louis and a speaker for Answers in Genesis. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you, Todd, for having me.
Well, it's very easy, and I think especially for Christians, to become distracted. How does Scripture begin? It begins most clearly with God's creation of this world. And there in Exodus 20, if you ever say, well, nowhere else in the Bible does it say there's a six-day creation. Yes, it does. In fact, God himself in Exodus 20, when he is giving his Ten Commandments, tells us very plainly how he did it and how long it took him. In 6 days, the Lord made the heaven, the earth, and the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. God is quite consistent. He doesn't speak there of a long or an old earth or long epochs of time. It's very easy to get distracted, however, from the point of that Genesis account, which, of course, does teach a literal six-day creation and does, for the Christian who takes God's word seriously, serve as the final authority to answer, ultimately, the claims of evolution. But lest we forget that the goal of this account is not merely to teach us where we came from, or that God made us, or how long it took him to make us, but that this God who made us intended for us, especially for us as we fell into sin after his good creation, redemption and salvation through his Son, Jesus Christ. Believe it or not, this is really God's purpose for creating the world in the first place. We're told by Scripture in no uncertain terms that before the very foundations of the world, that is, before God began on the first day to create the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, before the foundation of the world, God purposed in Christ to save us by his grace. That this God, after we had fallen into sin, did not stand around scratching his head saying, boy, they really messed up this project I had underway. No, he had already planned in his Son, Jesus Christ, even for our redemption and the forgiveness of our sins. In that event that stands even more central than creation, the cross and resurrection of his Son, Jesus Christ, for us. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen each week to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of Worldwide KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.